Welcome to this archived edition of Forthright Radio from June of 2015 with Gillan Darcy Wood about his book, Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World. As fires rage once again in California, both north and south, and the death toll mounts, we reconsider a fascinating chronicle of events of 100 years ago, which began in 1815 in a remote South Pacific island with a locally devastating, massive volcanic eruption that over the next 3 years so altered planetary weather conditions that it caused famine, disease, suffering, and the deaths of untold hundreds of thousands around the globe. It even resulted in Mary Shelley's creating her masterpiece, Frankenstein, or A Modern Prometheus, which was published 100 years ago in 1818. Both are cautionary tales. Welcome to this Forthright Radio for June 10th, 2015. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. With us for the hour is Gillan Darcy Wood, whose latest book is Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World, published by Princeton University Press. Here's a short quote. Out of sight and out of mind, Tambora was the volcanic stealth bomber of the early 19th century. Be it the retching cholera victim in Calcutta, the starving peasant children of Yunnan, China, or County Tyrone, Ireland, the hopeful explorer of a Northwest Passage through the Arctic Ocean, or the bankrupt land speculator in Baltimore, the world's residents were oblivious to the volcanic drivings of their fate. That's the end of that quote. 200 years ago this spring, Tambora erupted cataclysmically with extremely dire global consequences. What can we learn from this event as we face our own challenges in a rapidly changing climate? Stay tuned to find out. And now on to today's show with Gillan Darcy Wood, who is a professor of English and an environmental historian at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he directs the Sustainability Studies Initiative in the Humanities. Gillan Darcy Wood has written extensively on the cultural and environmental history of the 19th century. He is the author of The Shock of the Real, Romanticism and Visual Culture, 1760 to 1860. Romanticism and Music Culture in Britain, 1770 to 1840, Virtue and Virtuosity. An historical novel, Hossack's Folly, and most recently, the book we'll be discussing this morning, Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World, published in 2014 by Princeton University Press. Welcome to Forthright Radio, Gillan Darcy Wood.
Thank you, Joy, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, when our listeners find out what you have to say, it's going to be really amazing to them. In your book, Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World, you not only examine what happened in the physical world as a result of this cataclysmic eruption that happened 200 years ago, but also its impact on European and world arts and culture. It's my hope that in the next 50 minutes or so, we'll be able to explore this. But to start with, tell us what happened on April 10th, 1815, on that small island of Sumbawa near Bali.
All right. Well, imagine traveling across the globe from where we are down to the Pacific off the north coast of Australia in what was then the Dutch East Indies. It's the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and the war, that global war, has reached the Dutch East Indies. The English and French have fought over various islands in the East Indies, and the British are actually temporarily in control of Java and its surrounding islands, which include the small horse trading island of Sumbawa. And this, of course, this area of the East Indies belongs to the Pacific Ring of Fire, studded with volcanoes. So the residents there are habituated to the periodic explosion of volcanoes. And the largest peak in the East Indies was Mount Tambora, located on Sumbawa. It had been rumbling for a number of years, and it's emitted some smoke and ash on April the 5th. And then on April 10th, in the early evening, it exploded with cataclysmic force, the largest eruption on our planet for probably 5 or 10,000 years, possibly longer. Imagine 100 megatons of ash and smoke, minerals, gases, being projected up beyond the atmosphere, so beyond the sky, into the stratosphere at about over 40 kilometers. And if you imagine that the average aircraft, commercial aircraft, flies at 35,000 feet, the magmatic material from Tambora is being projected into 43,000 meters, so about three times or four times the height of your average airliner. And that's what enabled the fact that you have 100 megatons of material being ejected in that high above the atmosphere. That's what enabled Tambora to have more than localized disaster impacts and to, in fact, affect the entire globe through the change of climate over the succeeding 3 years. But in the immediate aftermath, of course, it's a horrific scene for the residents of Sumbawa and the residents of nearby islands in the Dutch East Indies. The death toll is the greatest in recorded history. Over 100,000 people die immediately, and in the weeks following, from fluorine poisoning of the water. And occurring in April, the eruption happened on the eve of the rice harvest. So there was an immediate and drastic food shortage, and you have many, many thousands of local people starving. When I visited Sumbawa a few years ago and climbed what remains of Tambora, about 2 kilometers of the mountain completely exploded and disintegrated in the 1815 eruption, so it is now no longer the highest peak in the area. Zimbabweans still remember the eruption. They have a kind of before and after history of their own island. They have a specific name for the event, and they tell stories about how wealthy the island and prosperous the island was before Tambora, that there was a great king who presided over a golden palace, and that since then, 200 years ago, the islanders have always been poor and have suffered ever since from the eruption. And it's interesting that very few native Zimbabweans live anywhere near to the volcano. There's a village on the slopes which I stayed, and it's inhabited by people from other islands. No one from Zimbabwe dares approach the volcano.
Now, you introduced in your book, Tambora, the Eruption That Changed the World, a word that I had not heard before, teleconnection. And this word seems to be very important to you. It's kind of like the crux of your entire book. What do you mean by teleconnection?
Okay. The easiest translation is remote connection. So I mean remote in time and, in this case, in particular space. So that, as you described so eloquently in your introduction, the book takes this single event that occurred in a particular place in the Dutch East Indies in 1815, but was of such dimensions that it was able to impact Arctic exploration, impact harvests in the Atlantic seaboard of the United States, to create a famine in China, to spawn a dreadful cholera outbreak in India. Now, how is it possible to link events over such vast spaces? The scientists who study volcanoes and study the environmental impacts of volcanoes, and also who study climate, they require a kind of concept of causality that is broader than the one that you and I use, the relationship between cause and effect. We like these causes and effects to be close to each other. We like them to be visible. We like them to be easy to understand. When it comes to a proper comprehension of our relationship to the environment, and in this case, my case study is a volcanic eruption, but we need to have a broader, more flexible and more nuanced understanding of the relationship between cause and effect. And Tambora is an excellent example of that, in that you have one major eruptive event occurring 6 degrees south latitude in the southern hemisphere, and because it was able to project so much matter into the atmosphere, that event was able to have planetary consequences. So writing the narrative of Tambora, the principle of teleconnection was absolutely indispensable, because it creates a story based in history and science where the entire planet is actually connected and involved in the one catastrophe.
I also found it very interesting the parallels that you draw between the end of the 18th century and our present time, which coincidentally, was the rise of the beginnings of the industrial era. It was also the Age of Enlightenment, in which all this scientific ferment was happening. And your parallels between the climate discussions in the 1780s and how passionate they were then, with the pros and the cons, and what our current situation is with climate deniers, et cetera, et cetera. It's very useful to have these historic perspectives. But speaking of perspectives, trying to gauge the power of this event, which was, well, first of all, congratulations that you were able to do the sleuthing to put this book together, because that was very, very difficult. There is hardly any mentions of the explosion, but you ferret them out and put them together. So congratulations on that.
It was like a detective story in a way, because we don't really work with this principle of teleconnection, that we're not accustomed to looking at the world in terms of the remote consequences of events or our own actions on the environment and on community and human communities that are distant from us. We're not accustomed to thinking in this way. It required me to sort of step out of that shell of thinking and say, well, I need to follow these trails wherever they lead. And in many cases, as you say, the historical traces, you know, the paper trail was quite thin. There are fragments of the story told in, for instance, in New England. There's a folk memory and cultural memory of the year without a summer after the eruption of Tambora, when all the crops failed. And hundreds of New England families made their way west to Illinois and Kentucky and Ohio and Pennsylvania. So there's a rather strong folk memory there. I was recently at the 200th Bicentennial Conference about Tambora in Switzerland. Switzerland was the most impacted country in Europe. Terrible grain shortages, infanticide, civil disruption on a terrible scale. So it's remembered quite clearly in Switzerland. And in other parts of the world, there are isolated pockets of memory of various forms about the event. But they're before the book. There's no full narrative to tie all these little pieces of information together. And that required me as an historian, as a humanist, to read a lot of the scientific literature from different disciplines. Because in the scientific world, Tambora is recognized as a major ecological event. And it required me to read a lot of volcanology, epidemiology, and crop science, and to delve into different fields in order to create a story. And it's certainly not the usual way. It required a whole new methodology, I think, for me to be able to do it, which is why I think the book has gotten some attention, because people are interested in this new way of thinking, and that it's a necessary way of thinking because it's so pertinent to our own time, where we are used to thinking so sort of locally and narrowly about what's happening to us and the environmental deterioration and climate deterioration that we're facing, when in fact it's necessary to have a hemispheric and even planetary view of what's going on.
We are speaking with Gillan Darcy Wood about his book, Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World.
Well, speaking of your methodology, quite a bit of the information comes from ice core samples in Greenland, for example. Mm-hmm. And I can't help noticing that the glaciers are melting at a very, very accelerating rate, so that information that isn't gotten soon is not going to be available. Am I right about that?
Well, it depends on where you are in the North or South Polar areas. Ice core technology, and this is a very interesting part of the story, ice core technology only developed in the 1960s and 70s. So this book certainly couldn't have been written before then. It's in the 1960s and 70s that you have teams of scientists first going to the Antarctic, Greenland, and the Himalayas, even so mountainous glaciers, and drilling down. And what you end up with is time travel. There's a kind of library or archive of climate conditions on planet Earth available that are recorded in the ice at great depth. But depending on how far you drill down, you can get hundreds or even thousands, and hundreds of thousands even, of years of climate data. So this is a remarkable turning point in the history of climate science, where we're able actually now, through ice core samples, to be able to look back and see what the climate conditions on Earth were like. And it's only through ice core technology that we're able to know, for instance, that you mentioned glacial melting, that the Arctic, for instance, is now being reduced. The ice caps, the ice, you know, ice coverage of the Arctic has been reduced to a state that it hasn't been so diminished for a million years. So we're able to kind of create a long-term history of climate conditions. And when it comes to Tambora, of course, when a major volcano erupts and its ash cloud envelops the globe, once those ashes eventually drop to Earth, they leave an imprint on the ice, a chemical imprint on the ice. And in the 60s and 70s, you begin to see papers, scientific papers, that about Tambora, saying there is a significant telltale imprint of a major volcanic eruption in 1816 in every ice core that we're drilling. And so you get this flood of papers coming out. And so it's quite a recent story in a way, that there was no real memory beyond the kind of folk memory. There was no official memory of Tambora, really, until you have ice core research, which begins to focus in on the year 1815 and 1816 and say this was a major ecological event. And it was in this context that I first got the idea for the book. I was looking to write about climate change and to provide some historical angle on climate change, since that was my area of expertise. And I was sitting in an atmospheric science class in which the professor was discussing the relationship between volcanism and climate, and how volcanoes over time have had a significant impact on the climate of the planet. And the discussion kept turning again and again to this 1815 event. And I, even though this was my field of speciality as a cultural historian, I had no knowledge of Tambora at all. So in a way, the project grew out of a feeling of shame and embarrassment at my own ignorance. And I realized that the only proper punishment could be spending 5 years researching the subject, which I did. The book was on Tambora was the result. So from that moment in the climate class began an incredible 5-year intellectual journey for me.
Let's talk about some of the global effects, which were truly disastrous, of this explosion in April of 1815. Gillen Darcy Wood, explain what some of the impacts were. You mentioned Switzerland already. Talk about that, and also your synthesis of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and how the weather kind of caused her to write it, but also her writing of Frankenstein's monster was influenced by the disasters around her. I find it fascinating the way you've synthesized these two things.
Yeah, and for all the tens of thousands of words written about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and the fact that the story is so iconic and well-known, it's an example, I think, of our sort of blinkered view and our narrow view of the relationship between human culture and the environment no one's ever really remarked on the dire ecological and social conditions under which Mary Shelley wrote the book. She herself was, you know, she existed within a kind of bubble of privilege. She was in a way insulated from the worst aspects of the disaster that was happening around her. What is well known about the story of the creation of the book is that she and Percy Shelley the poet and Lord Byron and others were holidaying in Switzerland, in Geneva, on the lake, in the summer of 1816, which is the wettest, coldest summer in the history of Switzerland, as it's recorded. So what they had imagined as being sunny days, picnicking by the lake and boating, they ended up stranded indoors in the stormy, cold weather. And in order to pass the time, they decided to organize a ghost story competition. And one of them came up with what is a kind of vampire story that was the basis of Dracula. And Mary Shelley famously wrote Frankenstein as a result of this competition. So given that how young they were only, you know, Mary Shelley was 19 and the young men were only a few years older. They were essentially college age, and I'd have to say this is the most creative bunch of college age students on a summer holiday probably in the history of the world, who managed to produce two iconic cultural phenomena, The Vampire and Frankenstein. The story about the relationship between the weather and the poor weather and what Percy called Mary's storm-lashed novel. I mean, I'm sure anyone who's read the book will have memory of the violent storms in the novel and the general atmosphere of foreboding and violence. And certainly that is the atmosphere of 1816, the weather crisis and the social crisis that was enveloping Switzerland. But I take the argument a step further in the book, and I say that, well, if one looks at the figure of the monster himself, roaming the highways and byways of Europe, hungry and alone, shivering, and whenever he ventures into a village or town, he is hounded out. In fact, that was the experience of tens of thousands of Swiss and European peasants all across Europe in 1816, 17, and 18, as hundreds of thousands of people abandoned their farms for lack of crops and took to the roads and launched themselves toward, descended on the market towns in order to find food. And many market towns put up their walls and refused them entry because they themselves were suffering from food shortages. So you had a general social catastrophe unfolding all across Europe, information about which was suppressed largely by the authorities, who didn't want to produce greater panic. But if one digs deep, you can find this information about this terrible, terrible crisis. The historians have put it down, and traditionally they've put it down to the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars and saying, well, of course, this is part of the crisis of the aftermath of the wars. But in fact, the environmental and climatological drivers of the crisis are paramount, in my opinion. And so what you have with Shelley's figure of the monster is a kind of a symbol or an emblem of the suffering peasantry of Europe who, like the monster, became environmental refugees in this period, left to wander the roads. And just there are eyewitness accounts, some of which I quote in the book, but many of which, for reasons of space, I simply left out, but are referenced in the notes. There are horrific eyewitness accounts of starving children and thousands of people wandering the roads whom travellers in Europe, like the Shelleys, mistook for armies on the march. I mean, there were so many thousands of people, desperate people, wandering across Europe in this time. It's rightly been called the last subsistence crisis in Europe. It was the last time that Europe has faced a famine of that scale.
The show is Forthright Radio. I'm Joy LeClaire, and our guest today is Gillan Darcy Wood. We're talking about his book, Tambora, The Eruption That Changed History. At the same time, in Ireland, there was what you call the first famine. Most people, when they think of the famine in Ireland, they think of the 1840s that resulted in the waves of migrations, the millions dead, etc. But there was actually this first one after 1816, 1817, 1818. Talk about that, please.
Oh, yes. This was really a remarkable adventure, uncovering this under-recognized event in Irish history. We do have a tendency to cast everything pre-1840, pre-Great Famine Ireland into a kind of oblivion. And that's so very wrong, because what occurred between 1816 and 1818 and the aftermath of Tambora was a kind of prelude to the Great Famine of the 1840s. It's the first time that the potato crop failed. And in many ways, it should have acted as a wake-up call to Ireland's vulnerability, the vulnerability of its food system, its food insecurity, as we would call it today. And there should have been better provisions made ready for the 1840s. But I see it as this is a generation prior to the 1840s, and what you have is a very significant famine. So let's go through the sequence of events, the sequence of causes here. Why were the weather conditions in Ireland so bad? Well, what, you know, the climate system is complex and interconnected. And with a kind of planetary screen of volcanic matter enveloping planet Earth, you have a reduction in the amount of solar energy that's reaching the surface of the planet. So you have a drastic diminution of temperature, which is particularly important or devastating in summertime when one's attempting to grow crops. So we're thinking about a pre-industrial world largely in which most of the Earth's population is reliant on subsistence agriculture, and that's certainly true of Ireland. So there are lower temperatures, but what was particular about Ireland's case, and this is true of Western Europe and Switzerland as well, was an extraordinary amount of rain. And it has to do with the shifting. Because of the lowering of temperature, this affects air pressure, and it affects the formation of or the course of storm, major storm tracks across the North Atlantic. So you have a change in the storm tracks, and you have a shift in lower pressure systems that are moving sort of southward and being located around Ireland. So you have just a continual sequence of storms tailing in from the Irish Sea, from the North Atlantic over Ireland. And you have amounts of rain that are 5, 6, 8, 10 times the normal amount of rain. Ireland is, as you can, you know, picture the map, it's on the front lines there. And these storm systems are tracking all the way across England and Europe as well. So this is why England and Europe are, they're basically underwater in the summertime over 1816, 1817, and 1818. The croplands are just lakes. It's an incredible environmental disaster. And so in Ireland, you have the crops fail. Not just once, because these communities are adapted to bad seasons, yes? They're adapted to normal variability in climate conditions. They can deal with one or perhaps even two bad seasons. But this is what happened after Tambora, was that you had 3 full years, season after season after season, and 3 full summers of deteriorated climate and wretched conditions. So everything in Ireland is underwater. There's absolutely nothing to eat. I focus on the effect on the human population, and I only allude at the end of the book to saying, well, the animal population was absolutely devastated as well. So you have horses and animals, you know, dying in their hundreds of thousands. So these rural communities are in absolutely desperate shape, dying in huge numbers, setting out on the roads, environmental refugees. And then, of course, there's the second act of this story, where you have famine-friendly diseases begin to emerge under these deteriorated social conditions. So you have the famine and you have the death rate from the famine, which is in the hundreds of thousands in Ireland. And then typhus, which is the great accompanier of any famine, in particular one that is associated with cold conditions. So typhus, which is communicated via lice, thrives under conditions of extremely poor human conditions where you have groups of people, families, huddling together in the cold, and sharing clothing or blankets, because that's where the lice reside and they transfer themselves from body to body. And we have many historical accounts. In the book, I reproduce many of these eyewitness accounts to the horrific conditions in Ireland where you have whole families with nothing to eat and very weak and huddling together in their beds, you know, sharing coats, sharing blankets, and communicating typhus to each other via lice. Tens of thousands of people die from typhus in 1816, 17, and 18 in Ireland. And tens of thousands more emigrate in that period, mostly to the United States. So you know, we talked about teleconnection at the beginning of this conversation. Well, this is an excellent example that you have poor conditions in Ireland. Well, you have an eruption in Indonesia, which produces unseasonably cold and wet weather in Ireland, which decimates the population, which stimulates immigration to the United States. You have tens of thousands of immigrants in the United States. It's a new social era in the history of this country. So everything connects with each other, as you can see. I have an Irish heritage on one side of my family, and so I found myself getting very interested in the Irish dimensions of the story and really quite angry about it. But I felt it, you know, a real duty to recover this story. So many books, of course, have been written about the 1840s famine, and yet very little has been done on the 1816-1818 experience.
We are speaking with Gillan D'Arcy Wood about his book, Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World.
My heritage is also from the Irish, and in fact, my grandmother told me tales of her father talking about the British soldiers coming into their homes, and the farmers would hide their daughters, and they would hide what food they could. So it's not, I mean, that was from the 1840s mm-hmm. era, but it's within my oral history of father to daughter to granddaughter to et cetera, that I heard these things. And in fact, the British were still importing food from Ireland, even though the situation and taxes, a lot of the people were displaced because they couldn't pay the taxes in yeah. this 1816 to 1819 period. And you also point out that the primary source of heating in Ireland is peat. Yeah. And because of the flooding, it was too wet to burn.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine a sort of a more poignant nightmare kind of convergence of terrible conditions. So there was no remedy and there was no succor for these starving and suffering Irish in this period. And I mean, there's so many things to discuss in relation to Ireland, and that I found this pattern repeated in a number of dimensions of the story, in that so where our histories of the 1840s and our memory, our cultural memory of the 1840s in Ireland is kind of year zero, what it did was erase the memory of prior disasters, including 1816 to 1818. I found that to be the case in China as well. The chapter on China where I write about actually famine conditions that are really quite similar in many ways to what occurred in Ireland in the period, you know, starving peasantry. And in that case, the child slavery was an interesting part of the story. In China, it is traditional that in times of extremity, one sells one's children in order to survive. No Chinese historians that I contacted and talked to really knew anything about the event. And it's because, well, if you think a little bit about the history of China in the subsequent 200 years, its famines and revolutions and great leaps forward and extraordinary levels of suffering and death and tumult, this tragedy, the 1816-18, had been basically forgotten. It had been erased by subsequent catastrophes. So it just goes to show, I suppose, that our history is very selective. And what's passed down to us, well, certain events get passed down and others are forgotten, are left behind. And I think one of the fulfilling things about writing this book was it was a kind of recovery mission. It was bringing back to life, in a way, the stories that had been left behind from 200 years ago. And stories about a climate crisis that are so, you know, pertinent to us today. Our lives are very different from our forebears 200 years ago. But nevertheless, we're facing our own challenges to do with a changing and deteriorating climate. And the lessons from 200 years ago are about, well, they're about large-scale human suffering, about our vulnerability to a changing climate, and about the different ways in which human communities can or cannot adapt when the weather changes over the long term. And we're now looking to ahead to a kind of untested, open-ended experiment with our climate. And it'll be, as I say at the very end of my book, I wonder what, you know, a historian of the future will be able to say about the way we are able or unable to adapt to our own climate crisis today.
In the news recently, May was just declared the wettest month in U.S. history, although this may be difficult for California listeners to hear because they're in epic drought conditions.
Yeah.
In India, the heat wave has killed already 2,300 people. In 2003, in Europe, a heat wave killed more than 35,000 people. This is post-industrial modern Europe we're talking about. In 1995, 750 people died in Chicago over 5 days. A couple of weeks ago, a tornado, unheard of, in China, tipped over a boat and killed 500-plus people. There's mass migrations in Africa and wars being fought. And this is just the beginning. So let's go to India, because India was hit really hard by the after effects of the Tambora eruption. Talk about how that played out in India. And then that'll bring up the disease cholera, and then how cholera spread around the world.
I think this is, in many ways, the centerpiece of the book. And it's the chapter of the book that gives the strongest argument for the planetary consequences and the planetary reach of Tambora's eruptions. Just in terms of the simple metrics of mortality, Tambora's influence on the disease dynamics of the Bay of Bengal had the greatest consequences of all, of anything that we've discussed. So to describe it briefly, India is the climate of India is driven by the annual monsoon. It's the largest, most dynamic weather system in the world over the Indian subcontinent. And what occurred after Tambora was, as I've said before, a depression of temperatures. This affects the monsoon because it sort of evens out the temperature differential between land and sea. And that's the driver of the monsoon, is that the land heats up more quickly than the ocean and the water. But with a decrease in solar energy reaching the Earth, you have a depressed differential between land and sea. And so you have a delayed monsoon, the worst in recorded history in India. So the monsoonal rains don't come. You have a terrible heat waves and drought. So you have a famine and you have drought associated with Tambora and the delayed monsoon. And then when the monsoon finally sort of churns into life, months late, it delivers flooding rains, 100-year level floods across India. So you have drought conditions followed by flood conditions. So you have weather extremities and natural disasters on a quite epic scale in India. Now, this would be, I say, merely local, but this would be a constrained environmental catastrophe if it were not for the impact of these weather extremities on the biological conditions in the Bay of Bengal. Now, for time immemorial, cholera has been endemic, is locally, specifically endemic to the Bay of Bengal area around Calcutta. Now, what occurred? So, we're talking centuries of a relationship between Bengal and cholera existing nowhere else in the world. Now, what occurs in the aftermath of Tambora is that the environmental conditions have changed so drastically that an event of a genetic transfer of the cholera microbe, which is itself a very highly adaptable, fungible sort of microbe, there's an unprecedented event occurs in the history of the cholera microbe by which it changes its character genetically, and it is able to reach further into the human population in the Bay of Bengal. It essentially finds a host of new victims and is able to spread beyond its usual zone in Bengal. Now, I opened the chapter with its impact on a British Army regiment in north central India during a military campaign and how it devastates them as a kind of introduction to the path that cholera was now taking out of Bengal and, in a way, a kind of an unstoppable trajectory that moves across through Asia in the 1820s, up to Western Europe, Eastern and Western Europe in about 1830, and then crosses the Atlantic to the United States in 1831 and 1832, which is when it enters US history. And one doesn't have to, there are plenty of books written about the terrible cholera epidemics in Philadelphia and New York, Baltimore in 1831. And there is, we've discussed, this is again a great instance of teleconnection, those outbreaks with their death tolls in the tens of thousands connected back to this new cholera that emerged in Bengal in 1816, 1817 as a result of the post-Tambora ecological conditions in the Bay of Bengal. Remarkable, really. So that it's difficult or impossible to imagine the 19th century without cholera because so much of social history was driven by that disease. The death toll in the tens of millions globally in the 19th century. A vast amount of medical and social reform literature surrounds cholera and adapting and dealing with cholera. It's definitive of the 19th century as we know it. And its origin, really, if we look at this hypothetically, it could not have occurred or would not have emerged in the way that it did absent the eruption of Tambora in 1815, which created the precise conditions that were required for a radical genetic alteration in the cholera bacterium. Now, how do I know this? This is something as I could not have known without very recent epidemiological research in the relation between climate change and cholera that has really only begun in the last 10 or 15 years. There are a couple of major researchers in the United States who've worked on the climate-cholera relation. And it was into their work that I delved in order to construct or reconstruct the physical conditions of India in 1816 and build a highly probable circumstantial case whereby there is a connection between these two major ecological events in the 19th century, that is the eruption of Tambora.
I want us to focus on its impact on North America.
Sure.
But I do want to quote, I really appreciated your analysis. You said that abolition politicized race in the 19th century, cholera politicized class and sanitation. Yeah. Sanitation and slavery were the premier social justice issues of the 19th century. I thought that was an excellent synopsis. Talk about the impact of the 1800 and froze to death in North America.
Yeah, and this will could be of great interest to American readers of the book. Like any major climate event, and like the climate change that we're experiencing today, the impacts are highly unpredictable and uneven. I mean, various parts of the planet were less affected than others. And this is true even within the continental United States. The Atlantic seaboard suffered terribly from drought and cold, a mixture of drought and cold conditions in 1816 and 17. So crops failing up and down from Virginia all the way to Maine and New Hampshire. But across the Appalachians and in the Midwest, where I'm talking to you from, there, for whatever complex climatological reasons, the impacts were not as dire, and so crop yields were at or near normal. So you can imagine what market forces begin to come into play once you have a terrible crop yield deficiencies in New England, in the centers of population on the east coast of the United States, and we're now suddenly relying hugely on the grain production from what was then the frontier northwest, states like Ohio and so you have an increase of grain sailing down the Mississippi to the New Orleans market, and a quintupling of the amount of grain being sold there, and prices of grain go through the roof as these basic commodities become scarcer and scarcer on the transatlantic markets. So farmers in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois make a killing, and we have a great deal of real estate speculation. A lot of money coming into the Midwest, what is now the Midwest in this period, even while there's a social and agricultural crisis on the East Coast. Then, of course, the other shoe drops, which is that Tambora, the impacts of the eruption on the climate have an endpoint. After 3 years, the volcanic ash is fully washed out of the atmosphere and conditions return to normal. So in 1819, the production of crops returns to normal across Europe and across the east coast of the United States. And so you have a precipitous drop in the price of grains and major cereals. So people who bet the bank on sustained high prices lose their shirts. To give you an idea of the scale of the economic fluctuations here, in the aftermath of Tambora, Kentucky went from having no banks whatever to having 35 banks in a couple of years, specifically because of the influx of money. And then all of those banks failed in 1819, and what is known to historians as the Panic of 1819, the first great economic crisis in the history of the Republic. And I quote Thomas Jefferson in my chapter, who said not a dollar was passing from hand to hand. So there's a great credit squeeze, so money was not to be had, you know, domino effect of bankruptcies across the country. And it's a kind of a precursor to the Great Depression of the 1930s. You have little shanty towns, you have people running off with their families into the forest to escape bankruptcies, people hiding in churches, overflowing jails. I mean, it's a major social crisis in the United States. Again, one that has been largely, you know, it's not something we learn about in the schools or teach in the schools, something that's been forgotten, I suppose, because it's eclipsed by other events. But again, this was another aspect of the book which recovers or rediscovers this major event. And the economic impacts of the Panic of 1819 really shaped the nation all through the 1820s. There wasn't really economic recovery until the mid-1820s. And in fact, Vermont took decades to recover from the loss of population that occurred in the aftermath of Tambora and from the economic crisis, from the economic crash that followed.
Gillen, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. There is just so much more in your book, Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World. Folks, you're just going to have to read it for yourselves.
Yeah, there's a lot more in it, I promise.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio, Gillen Darcy Wood.
Thank you, Joy. It's been a great pleasure.
The pleasure has been ours. Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Gillen Darcy Wood. His latest book is Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World, published by Princeton University Press. There was whole sections we didn't get to, just not enough time. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Thanks for engineering today to Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LeClaire.
We will go out with selections from Hymnody of Earth, composed by Malcolm Dalglish, to poems by Wendell Berry, in memory of those who have died or lost loved ones in the California fires. We'll hear Paradise and Shake These Bones. May they rest in peace, and may we learn the lessons of history so as not to repeat them. Until next time, this is Joy LeClaire, signing out for now.
Dear Lord, I wander here below. Glory, hallelujah. I sing to you that I may know. Glory, hallelujah. Have I a seat in paradise? Glory, hallelujah.
I'll show you how I'm feeling morning and day. I'll shake these bones and shout and sing my life away. I'll shake these bones and I will shout and sing my life away. It won't be long before these bones turn to clay.
Sure.